Hello and welcome to our special episode of our podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to business people, journalists, ambassadors, artists, sports heroes, leaders and luminaries from all over the world. My name is Siebe van der Zee and I'm your host. I'm originally from the Netherlands, happily residing in the Grand Canyon state of Arizona in the United States, and I'm also known as the Dutchman in the desert. This podcast is sponsored by PDF, the Professional Development Forum, and you can learn more about PDF at theprofessionaldevelopmentforum.org. Today's episode is a special one because we are at the end of the year, ready to begin a new year and a new chapter in our lives. It is interesting how we can discuss, analyze, and know everything in detail about what took place this past year. And of course, we don't really know what the next year will actually bring us. We set our goals and resolutions. We try to keep reasonable expectations. And yet, every new year comes with surprises, right? Keep this in mind when you listen to this very special episode of our podcast about some unique life lessons based on highly unexpected and very serious challenges. And I hope you will agree, nothing beats perseverance. Perhaps something to keep in mind when you consider your own journey into the next year, into the future. On behalf of our team at 10 Lessons Learned, I wish you all the best in the new year.
Our guest today is Conrad Taylor. Welcome, Conrad.
Oh, delighted to be here. Thank you.
Conrad is a very impressive individual. He grew up in the country of Guyana in South America, located just to the east of Venezuela, to the north of Brazil, to the west of Dutch Guyana, known as Suriname, the country. And he has a long-standing, over 35 years experience in business, including as a CEO at three multinationals, two mid-sized companies, and two startups. He holds a bachelor's degree in engineering from the famous United States Military Academy at West Point and a master's degree from the Sloan School of Management at MIT in Boston. Wow, what a background. Now, Conrad ventured into the unknown when he wrote his award-winning memoir, Path to Freedom, My Story of Perseverance. It is a very powerful story about survival, his survival. His book is displayed at the famous Smithsonian Institute in its museum library. Very impressive. Conrad currently serves on the Council of Senior Advisors for the Cicero Group, a well-known management consulting firm. He loves making a difference. Most importantly, in my opinion, he is a lifelong soccer fan. Welcome, Conrad. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Very nice to have you as a guest on this podcast. We'll be talking about wisdom, and your background is impressive. And I know, of course, a lot of details about your background. It has been an amazing journey, highly successful in business, and you currently still are active in business. But the first part of your life, and you're going to share that with us, is something that I think makes a deep impression on many people around the world. So we're very happy to have you here. And before we get into the lessons learned, I'm curious, is there perhaps a first lesson in business that you learned that you can share with us?
Siebe, yes. It was one of those things that at the time you didn't know you were learning it. But what I learned was my first lesson was to embrace my being a collaborative situational leader. And, you know, the collaborative side of me appreciates others with humility and, you know, values everyone's opinion. And the situational side of me knows when to step up and when to step back. And that was a lesson that I think has served me well throughout my career.
Collaborative leadership, you mentioned that.
Correct.
And that would mean collaborating with people around you, and they would have to collaborate with you.
Yes, that's a good way of stating it, yes. And being open enough that people would feel engaged enough to collaborate with me.
It's a very strong point that you're making, especially if you put that into where you are coming from.
Yeah.
And perhaps with that, we can start with lesson number one: nothing beats perseverance. That sounds very general, but please share your story.
Well, there are several dimensions to this story, which occurred, I would imagine, if you try to put the time frame in the 50s and 60s. I grew up in Guyana, South America. And in the 60s, 70s, 80s, actually late 60s, 70s, 80s, I came of age in the United States also. And as I mentioned, growing up in Guyana in those years, it was a different time than it is now. I grew up in a remote mining town deep in the upper reaches of the Amazon rainforest. And humble beginnings. My dad was a tailor and subsequently at some point became a welder. And that bauxite mining town was one that was typical of frontier towns that you find all over the world. Certainly in the U.S. here also, as the West was won, so to speak. And fast forward to what that all meant, what it meant was at an early age, had to understand and prioritize in the context of the kinds of examples that I was exposed to in such a frontier type situation. There were the hard charging folks who went to work, worked hard, but they played hard. And then there were others, trying to make a living, in that kind of remote setting, and learned early on, what it meant, what all of those elements meant, in terms of forming a community, and to determine, what of all of those you value or don't value. Well, some of that was not dictated by me wholly, my parents, who, had very basic, schooling. They were they were smart people. And they had not had, the kinds of opportunities that they wanted myself and my siblings to have. And so they prioritized education. Out of that, in that process, I fortunately was able to do fairly well. Through grade school, ultimately, I went to the high school in my town, Mackenzie High School. Out of that process, I was able to do well enough that I won a scholarship to Queens College, which is a high school in the capital city, about 65 miles downriver, because we lived upriver, deep in the jungle.
In the rainforest.
Yes. And that's a little bit more than it sounds, because the 65 miles was all by river. There were no roads between my mining town and the capital city, or just about any other city. So in any case, those were the kinds of things that, as a young kid, learned to have to deal with. And in fact, not knowing any better, thought it was all normal and fun. Well, fortunately, my parents were supportive enough that with the opportunity to get to go to this much better school, one of the best high schools in the Caribbean, I was able to get there and do well enough that ultimately won a scholarship to West Point.
Wow.
Now, the one thing I'd like to mention before going any further was, in the period as I lived in that mining town, there was a searing experience that occurred where there was some uprisings and ethnic strife and looting and killing and so on and so forth. That's what, at age 14.
Wow.
That's when I really understood why my parents were so adamant about getting their kids a good education.
Education first, right?
That was this. Yep. So it was a way out.
I can understand. And you did well, and you made it to West Point. I mean, right. We're talking very elite military school.
Yes. Yes.
That must have been an amazing experience. And obviously you graduated. It all looked good, right?
Yes, it did. Yeah, it did. I spent 4 years at West Point, having arrived there, really not knowing what West Point was really all about.
Sure.
Other than it was a scholarship opportunity for me. And I was one of 10 students from Latin America and the Caribbean that was awarded a scholarship to attend the academy. And so that was obviously a euphoric thing at the time. made all the national newspapers. I was the first from my country to ever go to an
school
like that. And so the 4 years at West Point and all the things that happens in a regimented situation happened. They were formative years, and without any of the gory detail, the main thing I can say is that along the way, there were many rude awakenings at West Point, including the culture shock of coming from this underdeveloped country into the big United States and upstate New York.
Absolutely.
And with peers from all over the country, every state pretty much. And like I said, 10 students from Latin America and the Caribbean. And having said all of that, that became a crucible for me to return to Guyana armed with an engineering degree and military training that supposedly was going to be an asset.
A hero.
Yes.
Turning to your home country.
Absolutely. Well-trained, a good education, and returning eagerly to serve.
And then what happened?
Well, West Point turned out to be a liability rather than an asset. What happened was because of West Point, I arrived, let me back up a little bit. The key point is, when I left Guyana, it was pro-American and democratic.
Mm-hmm.
When I returned to Guyana 4 years later, it was anti-democratic. Rather, it was anti-American.
Mm-hmm.
It was a totalitarian state, and it was aligned with the Soviet bloc.
Wow.
That became a soup that got me almost drowned, killed. And the reason for that was that my military training at West Point occurred in a way that the folks back in Guyana did not really fully understand what that was all about. What they saw was a potential threat. And the paranoia of the time and power and everything else.
Were you considered a spy?
Yes. That was really ultimately felt that I was in cahoots with the United States to potentially overthrow the government. Of course, that was the furthest thing from my mind. Didn't really understand any of that, and really didn't understand initially what
you went back to your native country.
Yes. Expecting to have a really good time contributing to the country's development, and had all the tools I felt to do that, but wasn't allowed to do that. Instead, within the first month or so, I was placed on the house arrest. I was jailed, was put on a watch list, and just a whole bunch of other repressive measures that were now part of what Guyana had become, which, of course, I was unaware of before coming back.
I mean, if we're talking about your lesson, nothing beats perseverance. I mean, when you go through this experience, as you have, how did you get out of there?
Well, over a period of 4 years, there was a variety of gates, so to speak. The first part of my, beyond being, thrown in jail, etc., I went into the Army, and as opposed to the normal things you think about it in terms of, someone with my kind of background and training, the Army was really a punitive type step. It was a way to kind of make sure that it had eyes on me in a way that only in the military you could be subject to, the kind of close discipline and scrutiny that in this particular case that the paranoia produced. So that part of it occurred early on. All my classmates at West Point had graduated as second lieutenants, went back to Guyana. My training at West Point was deemed irrelevant, and I went back as a cadet. And during that time, was denied promotion, while at the same time being given the responsibility of upper ranks, in fact, of a major. So supposedly what I had to offer was of that caliber that I had those responsibilities, but did not have the rank.
Wow.
There was a bunch of things that happened in between to get to that point. But in any case, the escape was what happened was planned, an escape understanding that the situation was getting more and more untenable for a variety of things that had occurred. And one day I went home. My wife, at that time we had two kids. I'd heard a newscast on my way home. The newscast had stated that one of the two West Pointers was involved in a national strike. Well, the other West Pointer was a gentleman by the name of Chetram Singh, who we were we're at West Point in the same class. Technically, I was appointed first, and then a couple of weeks later, you know, he was appointed to go to West Point. So we both went through this experience that I'm describing, at least certain elements of it. And because of all the things that we'd gone through together, we knew that when he was in trouble, I would be in trouble. When I was in trouble, he would be in trouble. So we had our own way of understanding what was going on. The fact that they were saying that on a national news said to me that the jig was up and that I had to get out of there. Went home, told my wife we're leaving. And again, without all the gore, which is, there's more of that in the book, I was fortunate after a couple of missteps, was able to escape and arrived in the United States in January of 1977 in the cold on dead of winter.
Wow. Wow. I mean, an impressive story. It makes me think, I know the second lesson that you gave me, dealing with uncertain situation, mm-hmm. hones a figure it out mindset. And you have, I think, already addressed that quite a bit. You had to figure things out being in a very, very difficult spot and right. made it to the United States. And I see lesson number three, you talk about a setback can be a setup for better.
Yep.
And that's really what evolved, right? After your very rough beginning and the treatment you received, you set yourself up for better. Can you address that a little bit?
Yes, I can. There are two dimensions to that. The one that is implied by the way you asked that question, which is, for all the trials and tribulations in Guyana, it prepared me in ways that at the time didn't fully appreciate.
Yeah.
The stages along the way after the military and after some difficulty was I was allowed to leave the military and was employed by a British multinational. It had a subsidiary of pharmaceutical operation in Guyana. And I was initially employed there as an engineer to fix a problem. And ultimately, I was promoted after success in that position to the production manager, basically, you know, the plant manager. And when I arrived in the United States, the first thing that happened was after spending about 5 days in New York City with a big sigh of relief, because until we landed in New York, didn't know whether or not we were going to be taken off the plane and et cetera.
Wow. Yeah.
We left Connecticut, and that's where I embarked on my first job in the United States. And one of the things that happened then was the job search turned out to take a little longer than I had expected, because having arrived in the U.S. with a bachelor's degree in engineering, experience in a British multinational in Guyana, in the position that I held, I felt that that experience would position me for a quick job search. It didn't turn out that way. It took about 3 months. And when I got an offer, it was well below and incommensurate with my qualifications. But I was broke because I had arrived in the U.S. for $15 Guyana, which was not acceptable on the international money market exchange. So with that in mind, I did not negotiate. I took the position.
You were happy to take the position.
Happy to take the position, because despite the disappointment in terms of how long it took and the low offer, it meant that I could at least take care of my family in a way that had not been able to until that point. And so what happened then was within about a couple of weeks of taking the job, my bosses realized that this guy could do a little bit more than we had employed it for. My position at offer was to be a production control assistant at a medical device plant in Connecticut. And the thing that happened then was I assumed more responsibility within 2 weeks. Wow. But my pay did not change.
Oh.
But the fact of the matter was, I was committed to doing everything that I could to overperform. As a matter of fact, that's my responsibility was to do that. and to prove myself in a way that allowed me to ultimately be promoted ahead of schedule, but sometime after several months I'd already been underpaid. But the setback in that particular case allowed me to establish myself in this new corporate America, and with a track record now that I was able to take and move on to a better position elsewhere.
I think that's a very, very strong point and truly a lot of wisdom, because you took the job not because of the pay, you needed the job.
Yes.
But your mindset was, I'm going to work as hard as possible. I'm going to perhaps overperform, you know, go beyond expectations, because somewhere I will succeed.
Yes.
And I think that's, of course, a lesson for many people. And I value that, you know, when people talk about jobs that they were in, and not to say, oh, I don't like this job, but you make the best of it. And in that sense, that is something that is good to share. And I think it's very helpful for people in the current situation we're dealing with around the globe.
Yeah.
With lots of adversity, hard to find a job. So sometimes you take a job that is perhaps below the level where you think you're at, but you give it your best, and it will set you up for better, right?
Absolutely.
That's part of the lesson. Yeah.
Totally agree with that.
Yeah. Lesson number four, don't be afraid to pursue seemingly career-ending opportunities. It's like a step up from what you just said, right? Career-ending opportunities, who would be interested?
I was, and I think that was in my mid-career period, in terms of the things that were happening by then. Because after the first job and kind of being unpaid and still doing well, it then set me up to ultimately, for example, in the move, I moved to Massachusetts, and I went to work with Polaroid, and I was technical position in managing a pilot group that was doing research on one-step film. And during that process, that was a step up, a very well-known and dynamic company. And while during that time, I felt that I'd milked my undergraduate for all it was worth. And so I applied to and got into MIT, where I was able to earn a master's degree that then allowed me to then step up further, which at that point meant that I was kind of on a track that at least had some promise.
From a remote area, a rough terrain area in Guyana, going through your experience, West Point, coming back to your country where you were basically accused of being an American spy. You were treated poorly. You made it back to the United States. Now you're in Massachusetts following your career, getting your degree at MIT. Isn't that enough yet?
Well, that was pretty good. But the fact of the matter is, you do those things and you find yourself, at least I found myself, my leadership style, which I mentioned before, the collaborative situational kind of thing, tended to fit the more risky kind of change agent type situation. And in fact, even before my degree at Polaroid in that supervisory position, it was a group that had been underperforming. And fortunately, it all worked out, terrific people, and got them engaged, and we did great things. Well, after leaving, I was recruited to go to Chicago to work with Baxter Healthcare. And in that capacity, I was able to cycle through staff and line positions with a whole lot of risk involved, because again, I don't know if I have a death wish or what, because the more problematic the situation, the more energized I got. And in the process, was able to, do some stuff on a global scale, was part of a team that developed Baxter's first worldwide manufacturing strategy, which allowed me to be able to interact with subsidiaries around the world, travel to other places to do part of what that meant. fact-finding, among other things, and developing strategy, spent some time in Brussels in that process, all the while, you know, trying to break new ground, trying to find, you know, the light in a dark room, find the switch, and treated every opportunity as if it was my last shot. And I would say that developing that kind of track record as a fixer ultimately didn't end my career. At some point, it led to my eventually becoming, you know, the CEO of a faltering company a little bit later on in my career, among other things that happened while at Baxter, you know, was placed in a couple of turnaround situations there also. So that's where the career ending piece of it comes, because typically my opportunity, especially I found that as a Black professional, it was a way to kind of get noticed. And if you take on those kinds of assignments and do well, you know, especially a Black immigrant, it kind of builds a little bit of, you know, credibility that allows you to get a benefit of the doubt, et cetera. So that's what that was all about.
You make it sound as if it's not a big deal almost, but education, you started with that, right? How important education was.
Yes.
But then your mindset, having dealt with lots of adversity and, yes, and being attacked, literally attacked.
Yep.
But your grit, your perseverance, and like you said, you know, don't be afraid to pursue seemingly career-ending opportunities. Of course, you're not saying take a career-ending opportunity, but don't be afraid, because you may be able to turn things around, and that's exactly what you did. Kind of makes me think of lesson number five, Conrad: make lemonade when served lemons.
Yeah, well, it's along those lines. It was a situation where I learned early on in my career and subsequently bore out that a mistake made, corrected, and then learned from is a mistake well made. I found that being bold, you know, added to my skill set. And as we talked about, the high risk situations, you know, solving problems in you know, messy situations, declining markets, rising costs, mm-hmm, inadequate resources, and the like. I've dealt with aspects of that and sometimes combinations of that, in being able to not always do, you know, the best job, but do well enough, often enough, that it helped me stand out in ways that make me look back and say, you know what? That could have been defined as a piece of something, and I was able to make it into soup.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And that's, of course, your mindset, your attitude. And at the same time, let's be real, it wasn't easy, right? You had a few successes, and from then on, it was just, you know, going along. No, you had to deal with adversity. The next lesson I'm so curious about, the working world is a Game of Thrones. I can think of all kinds of concepts when it comes to a Game of Thrones and the working world. I like to hear, of course, your interpretation.
Well, CB, this is based on my overall work-life experience. As I look back at it all, it's competitive out there. There's some very, you know, talented people. And, you know, there's always only so many slots, so to speak. And one of the things that I've observed, and I don't know if you would agree, but the most talented person does not, do not necessarily, get promoted. I found that look and fit, you know, count, who we know, who knows us, that's significant, you know, to career advancement. Or in this, sometimes, of course, I don't want that to sound as if it's all dark and everything else, because there's a certain degree of excitement and sense of accomplishment, you know, in competitive situations. And to be able to work through those, takes the bumps and bruises, and still live to fight another day, you know, develops a sense of, develops some capabilities and confidence that every step of the way serves for the next step. And in the process also, it helps want to be prepared to take your talents elsewhere if necessary, because of the fact that the personal growth that occurs in terms of, you know, your skills, experience, competencies, and also your ability to interact and adapt to many different types of situations. So the Game of Thrones aspect, certainly after many years competing for the spoils, showed me that as you navigate all of that, you know, all the thickets on the bush of challenges and opportunities, etc., that success could be around the corner. The idea is to continue to approach it with your most resilient and gritty self, you know, every day. That may not always be easy to do and may not always work, but it's always better than the alternative.
It sure is. It's a very interesting topic. The working world is a Game of Thrones. But I look at hiring individuals for companies as a recruiter myself. I typically look at, you know, can the person do the job? Does he or she have the experience, the qualifications? Will they love the job? Is there passion that they really want to work for this company, this organization, this industry, etc.? And then the third one is really, will it click between the people? Do they get along? And it is unlikely that you would hire someone that you say, I don't think I like that person. And it is more likely that you say, well, this person doesn't check all the boxes, but we really like him or her, etc., and we want to hire that person. You mentioned look and fit. And I realized that could be a podcast on its own, right? To talk about those qualifications. You have worked in different parts of the United States, obviously from Guyana. You also mentioned you were in Brussels in Europe. I have to ask you, look, is that important, the way a person looks?
That's reality, yes. And that could come in many forms. And at the end of the day, we all have, you know, our biases for one reason or another. And that's just reality. So yes, look and fit does matter.
Yes. And perhaps that's, you know, something over time that people can work on, because the way a person looks should not make a difference.
You would think so, but that's an ideal world.
I want to ask you another question, if you don't mind, and that has to do with the lessons that you shared, and I know there are many more lessons that you have learned in your amazing life career. Is there a lesson that you have unlearned in your life?
Tricky, tricky, tricky.
Yes.
Yes. I eventually had to admit that intent was not enough to achieve work-life balance. I once believed that the greater control, you know, that came at higher rank in an organization would make balance easily attainable. I learned that's easier said than done. And even for entrepreneurs, and you are an entrepreneur and you could probably, I'd appreciate your comment there, but, you know, I had a few stints as an entrepreneur myself, and turns out that this control, if we're talking about, you know, kind of it's fleeting. And as much as you, as an entrepreneur, call the shots, that you also have to make a living. And you have to do additional things than if you worked in corporate America. And so that puts us in situations, whether it's corporate America or entrepreneurship, in a situation where reality steps in and the work-life pendulum swings to extremes, you know, where you have an assignment or a new something to do and you got to immerse yourself in it. Even as you do that, you wish you can do something else and supposedly you have control. But if you use that control in a way that sabotages the livelihood that you're trying to create, then, you know, you got a different kind of problem. Now, of course, the other extreme is if you don't pay attention on the life side, you know, to spouses, friends, et cetera, there's another problem that occurs. And in the end, however, my reality and what I had to learn is that was really not the key thing. It was not really attainable in that way. It's usually you could get it in cyclical terms, maybe for a week, for a month, for a year, you could be in balance, but life has a way of intervening. That's kind of what I eventually had to admit.
A very, very good point. Very interesting. And no doubt you and I can talk much more about these things, and that's very tempting. But I thank you very much for participating in this podcast, where again, we dispense wisdom, and you provided a lot of wisdom. And I want to thank you for that, for participating.
Thank you very much. I totally enjoyed the conversation, and great questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your input, your information. You have been listening to the international podcast of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, produced by Robert Hossery and sponsored by the professional development forum, PDF. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, and parties. For more information, please visit professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Thank you very much, and stay safe.